In 2010, a municipality in Tennessee started work on an infrastructure plan that was going to be a little bit sneaky. They had received a federal grant from the Department of Energy to construct a digitally integrated electrical grid which would distribute energy to 170,000 customers in its district. The upgrade replaced the aging energy infrastructure with automated switches and real-time monitoring to give the utility provider more control over energy distribution while also reducing downtime from outages. According to the town's own energy board, the EPB, these modern upgrades would save $40 million a year in lost revenue from power outages, while also saving $3 million a year in maintenance costs on outdated tools. Now, local energy improvements are cool and all, but that's not what makes this story interesting. To connect all these switches and smart meters to homes, businesses, and their own control center, the town needed to lay down thousands of miles of network cables anyway. So they figured that, surely, there'd be no harm in extending those cables an extra few feet and using the new network to also carry internet traffic for all its energy customers as well. The new network was a massive improvement, to put it lightly. After the rollout was complete, the citizens of Chattanooga municipality were getting internet speeds 200 times faster than the national average. Prices were also more competitive and coverage more consistent. In the years that followed, this town bucked the trend of mid-sized Appalachian communities dying out and actually started growing its local economy. Instead of moving out to big cities, young people were actually moving in, attracted by a growing ecosystem of online businesses and predictable online work. Today, it proudly calls itself the Gig City, as the few million dollars a year in savings from the electrical grid have paled in comparison to the billions of dollars generated in the economy, all thanks to having fast, reliable, cost-effective internet. Other telecom companies saw this economic potential and the billions of dollars that could be generated from these comparatively modest investments and unequivocally committed to never letting it happen again. Major internet service providers have lobbied relentlessly to ensure that what happened here couldn't be repeated anywhere else across America. The industry has since collectively spent over $1 billion to influence laws designed to work against these public networks. Representative groups funded by these same companies have also routinely sued city governments for even considering offering something similar to their people. If all that wasn't enough, they also spent a lot of money airing some of the most boomer-pilled ads you've ever seen.
You can't expect a policeman to unclog your drain. You shouldn't ask a teacher to change your oil. And you wouldn't want a fireman to clean your teeth. So why would we let politicians take over our internet service? That's just not what they do. Experience proves government-run networks mean waste, corruption, and failure.
Their objective was pretty clear: limit competition so they could charge higher prices for a worse service. And it absolutely worked. A study by the International Telecommunications Union found that Americans were paying 3.2% of their net income in broadband bills, a number largely pushed up by consumers in the USA specifically. Here in the People's Republic of Europe, by comparison, we pay just 1.1%. However, this is more than just another story about corporate lobbying ruining everything. I know that alone is not going to shock any of you anymore. Instead, what you should probably know about is exactly how this industry has been so effective at shaping the law in a way that's clearly against the best interests of the people. Oh, and also the ways that other ISPs have watched America and are now slowly starting to pull the same tricks in other countries as well. Information has a global supply chain, with journalists, experts, partisans, and talking heads all working to get their version of events in front of you on a daily basis. That's why I trust Morning Brew to cut through the noise and give me the basics of what's really going on, and we're really excited that they're our first sponsor on Micro. A recent newsletter talked about the 996 grindset trend, where lots of young professionals are working from 9 a.m. till 9 p.m. 6 days a week just to get ahead of their competition. I hadn't heard of the trend, and while I'm no workaholic, I definitely resonate with the feeling of having too much to do and too little time to do it in. A good reminder to shut off the laptop more often and get outside, because I'd rather spend less time keeping up on new trends or business than I already do. That's why Morning Brew's free, quick, and easy-to-digest newsletter gives me just useful and timely information that I want with no fluff or spin. This newsletter has over 4 million readers now, and if your work involves business, finance or tech, or you just want to know what's really happening before the spin doctors get to it, and all in less than 5 minutes a day, you might want to join them. It's completely free and takes less than 15 seconds to sign up, so click the link in the description to sign up for Morning Brew for free or scan the QR code on screen now. Okay, so most industries where political lobbying is highly effective have a few things in common. The first and absolute most important variable is complexity. Think of all of the industries that have most successfully shaped laws in their favor. Pharmaceuticals, healthcare, banking, and of course technology are all the domains of highly educated career professionals. So even if lawmakers really were acting in the best interest of their constituents, they often depend on these industries to explain what it is they actually do. But follow along for the next 2 minutes, and I promise you'll understand more about how the internet works than 99% of the politicians passing laws about this stuff. When you sent a naughty picture to your friend via MSN Messenger, or whatever it is you kids are using these days, the connection between you and them is not nearly as direct as you might think. When you upload that image, what you're actually doing is sending data packets to the server hosting the chat. Those packets will go out through your router, through a last mile connection to your home, to a headend or network hub, which is either owner-operated by your telecommunications company, or they'll lease out capacity from a third-party provider. This central aggregation center will then send those data packets through internet exchange points where traffic is mixed together between different providers before it's directed to a Microsoft server, which will save these data packets locally. Since Microsoft and MSN Chat pride themselves on speedy communications even with larger files, the server will also send those packets out to be saved at various other servers around the world to form something called a content delivery network. The reason why you can watch this very video and skip seamlessly through that ad a minute ago is because YouTube makes copies that it then sends out to thousands of data centers that it's strategically positioned around the world to make sure you can always connect to a server with low latency where you live. As something of a balancing act to save on storage, extremely popular videos across the site will be stored on almost every data center around the world, where smaller, more market-specific content might only get hosted in a few dozen. For security and competition reasons, Google doesn't actually publicly share how it handles this data behind the scenes. In the case of your photo, though, the server will send a copy of those packets back out through the public exchange points and across the ocean using an undersea cable. A quick but interesting little detail is that Microsoft actually uses its own cable, MAREA, which spans from Bilbao in Spain to Virginia Beach in the US. It laid this particular undersea cable in partnership with Meta to handle their immense bandwidth requirements, since on any given day they're sending petabytes of data back and forth between Europe and North America. But anyway, at either end of the ocean, this cable connects to more exchange points which will eventually direct those data packets to another Microsoft server in North America where the copy will be saved. Then, when your friend reads the chat, their computer will connect through their ISP's network, through their own headend, through the exchange points to the local Microsoft server to request the image it will then send to them back down through the same pipe. Now that is the extremely basic breakdown of an extremely basic online interaction. I'm sure even then there are going to be a few actual network engineers in the comment section telling me what an idiot I am. However, the point is, your internet experience depends on so many delicate interactions between companies, governments, and cooperatives that it's frankly a small miracle that it works at all. If the average person can't wrap their head around it, then what hope do average lawmakers have? This technical complexity is mixed with a lot of legal complexity, which lets internet companies slip in laws tailored massively in their favor using three general arguments. Number one, it's expensive. Number two, nobody else can do it properly apart from them. And most importantly, providing an uncompetitive internet service is a God-given right laid out by the founding fathers in the Constitution. I am not joking. A majority of the problems average consumers have with their internet happens right down here in the connection between their ISP's headend and their home. Back in 1999, that last mile connection in Broward County had been installed and was managed exclusively by Comcast. Unsurprisingly, with no other options available, the service was not great, even by 1990s standards. The city attempted to introduce an ordinance that would allow other internet providers to share utility cables and bring some competition to the marketplace. Their argument was that since Comcast was using public poles and public land to run their network, they should be open to public competition. However, they did not like this idea, so they sued the city. When this case went to court, Comcast and a group of industry lobbyists argued that they were the press because they made programming choices about what messages to deliver and, more importantly, what messages to not deliver. In this case, the messages they were choosing not to deliver were any data packets carried by their competitors. What's more is that if the city government forced them to deliver these data packets via this new ordinance, that would violate their rights to free speech and free press as outlined in the First Amendment of the Constitution. It sounds dumb because it is dumb. But the judge sided with them, and now this ruling has been used as a foundation any time a local government tries to take away their rights to hold a local monopoly. Of course, cities like Chattanooga got around this problem by just building their own last-mile network. But the ISPs had a plan for that as well. Just like last-mile deliveries, last-mile connections are a major upfront investment with a lot of technical and practical barriers to entry. Local governments want to build this infrastructure because it will be popular with their voters who will appreciate the good internet. And the federal government has also pushed programs for better connectivity because it's aware of the larger economic benefits. So what the ISPs have done is target state-level governments, specifically with a barrage of lobbying and political donations. They've argued that if local councils are allowed to build this infrastructure themselves, they could go bankrupt given how expensive and difficult it is to build those networks. That would mean that the state government would have to bail them out, presenting a significant financial burden that could be avoided if only they just let private enterprise handle it all for them. They've also argued that any attempt by the federal government to build out this infrastructure is a violation of state sovereignty. So they physically bottlenecked connections at the local level and legally bottlenecked them at the state level. It's all very transparent, but the average voter just doesn't understand how these systems work, so there's little risk to lawmakers who side with these companies. Now, if there's any actual pushback, the final argument is old, reliable, free market efficiency. If companies can't guarantee captive customers in a given area, they won't have any incentive to reinvest or innovate because they won't own that market. This has been the general messaging of a lot of industry groups running those dumb ads. But the problem is, they aren't innovating anyway. 15 years later, the broadband in Chattanooga is still some of the fastest anywhere in America. And other internet service providers are allowed to compete in the same market if they want to, proving that competition doesn't stifle innovation, it encourages it. But if you're feeling smug laughing at the Americans, you should probably know that telecommunications companies across the world have seen how lucrative shaping laws in America has become, and they are trying to do the same thing by pushing the technical limitations of their own local laws. It's also not just internet services that fall victim to this strange blend of private enterprise protected by public legislation either. As I was putting this video together, Hank Green released a video about electrical companies pulling the same kind of shenanigans in Georgia. So if you're from there, I'll leave a link to that video below as required watching. One last thing that holds the US back is that it costs a lot more to service sprawling suburbs compared to more densely populated cities and towns across Europe and Asia. This is something that the companies and industry groups also really like to highlight as a significant cost driver, and that's fair enough. Except for the fact that this line of reasoning is almost always used as a way to ask the government for financial assistance to help them build a network that they will have a monopoly over. The Institute for Local Self-Reliance published a comprehensive list of these monopolized networks that were built using public funds, which is not great by itself, but to steal a line from the old crew, it gets worse. If a local government has already contributed millions of dollars in financial assistance to one company to build out their network, they're not going to spend the same money all over again to help out another company. So what they end up effectively doing is creating a publicly funded moat protecting a private business from public competition. Anyway, if you think this system is dumb, go and watch this video next to find out how the financial system is undermining the way the economy is supposed to operate.